Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Christian Cruz Limsico from Amsterdam, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, and thank you to Christian in Amsterdam for your intro and for your support in the year 2020. What a year it's been. It's been three whole days since our last tennis podcast, and very little tennis has happened in the intervening time. So we thought, why not do another one? just to update you on tennis news from that three-day period, we've been denied Dominic Thiem against Stan Wawrinka. Yes, I am pronouncing it Wawrinka. Apparently, we've been pronouncing his name wrong for the past 15 years. So I'm just going to keep saying it correctly over and over to try and make amends.
He's just got to play another 15 years to balance it up.
Yes.
Now.
It turns out Andy Murray was getting it right all along. I can't believe we ever doubted him. So Christian Garin has denied us Wawrinka against Thiem because he got the better of Wawrinka. Dominic Thiem, the defending champion, is still in. Novak Djokovic won his first round match against Filip Krajinovic, which means that Djokovic has secured the year-end number one ranking for a sixth time in his career, provided, big caveat here, that Rafael Nadal doesn't enter to play the tournament in Sofia, which I hope I'm not speaking out of term when I say I think is unlikely. Although he has confirmed he intends to play Paris and London, which is also unexpected. So who knows? Sofia, don't get your hopes up, but stranger things have happened. We've also had a couple of stories break in the past 48 hours off the court, both of them surrounding Alexander Zverev, both of them coming as a real shock and surprise to the tennis world. The first of them, the news that his ex-girlfriend Brenda Patea, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is expecting a baby. We understand she's expecting Alexander Zverev's baby. She's first of all, there was an Instagram post. She subsequently done an interview in Germany where she's stated that she won't be seeking joint custody, but Zverev is welcome to be involved with raising the child if he should wish. We have got a statement from Alexander Zverev that's come out this evening that I'll share with you in just a moment, but that statement also covers the second story which is broken today regarding Zverev, which is rather distressing. It is an accusation of domestic violence from his former girlfriend, Olya Sharapova, who many news outlets, including The Telegraph and The Daily Mail in the UK, are reporting on. She was in a relationship with Alexander Zverev until last year. She claims he hit her head against the wall and tried to strangle her, which is obviously hugely, hugely distressing a thing to hear. We have had a statement from Zverev, as I said, just in the last half an hour or so, and it reads thus: "The last days were quite challenging for me. I will be a father at age 23, and I am very much looking forward to the child. Even though Brenda and I are no longer together, we have a good relationship, and I will live up to my responsibility as a father. Together we will take care of the little person that is about to grow. I don't want to say more in public about this private subject. I'm sure that Brenda and I can manage it without the media involved. Then there are the unfounded accusations of my ex-girlfriend Olga Sharapova, which I read in the media today. They make me very sad. We have known each other since we were children and shared many experiences together. I very much regret that she makes such statements, because the accusations are simply not true. We had a relationship, but it ended a long time ago. Why Olga is making these accusations now, I just don't know. I really hope that the two of us will find a way to deal with each other again in a reasonable and respectful way." So that is where we're at with that story. I don't know if there'll be any further developments. It's obviously something that is really made the tennis sports news world sit up and pay attention. As and when, you know, there is news and developments, we will keep you across them. But that's obviously a hugely distressing story to read and hear about. But we are going to move on to slightly happier, well, hopefully happier topics. It depends what comes out in the bag of questions, doesn't it? You've been sending in your questions in there, I'm going to say dozens. Does dozens feel right, Matt?
Can you say hundreds if it's over 100 but less than 200?
Yeah.
I don't think you can. I think it needs to be more than 200.
Dozens, it is.
Dozens. What about droves?
Yes.
It's enough,
I think
isn't it?
Droves is a non-specific large quantity. So thank you for your droves of questions. The overall quality has been extremely high, and we've had to have a very stringent selection process. So many apologies if your question hasn't made the cut. We will, of course, be doing future Any Questions shows, so there'll be other chances for you to get your questions answered. I mean, we've agreed amongst ourselves to do about 4,000 podcasts between now and the end of the year, so I'm sure there'll be other Any Questions shows popping up. But we're going to start. I'm gonna fire some questions at you, folks.
Great.
Ready?
Well, you're going to answer them
Go
as well,
for it.
I hope.
So we're going to start with a nice easy one. It comes from Moines. This came in on Instagram, and it is: who is the best at tennis? And I assume Moines means out of Matt, David and Catherine, and not out of people in the world, because the answer to that is at the moment Novak Djokovic. So if you're talking about myself, Matt and David, I'm going to say Matt.
Yeah, but it depends on the era, doesn't it? You know, are we talking right now?
In 1988, you were better at tennis than I was, David, yes?
Correct.
Right.
No, but if we were to go back just a few years, for instance, I mean...
Oh, you know, peak
is there
against
a
peak.
Yeah, well, is there a window when you injured or something?
I think at my peak, I might have a decent game against Matt.
When were your peak, Catherine?
Well, pre-back operation.
Yeah, obviously. Well, Catherine played against me in 2014, in December 2014. We only played a 10-point tie break.
And I won twice.
You won twice.
Yeah.
Because I needed Hawkeye, really, to come into to play. My eyes failed me on a particular line call, and I caused some aggro. But actually, I'm the only one who's played both of you.
Yeah,
right?
That is
And
is
I would
true.
Say, so I played 2014, Catherine. Have you been much better than you were in that sort of time?
Yeah.
You have.
Definitely. That was not me at my best. And I will concede, reluctantly, David, that probably wasn't you at your best either.
No,
I would
no.
like to think, given my memories of that day, that was neither of us at our best.
Look, I mean, there's no question you would both thrash me if you're playing well, either one of you, because I've not really been. I'm sort of self-taught, really. I've had a couple of lessons, but I mean, I am a hacker, really. I don't really know what I'm doing half the time. but I would quite like to see a match between the two of you if you both played your best, because you've got you both got strokes that I sort of look at, and they look proper strokes to me. You know, that's the difference.
I will try and re-peak. If you can just maintain your peak, Matt, I'll attempt to re-summit mine. I'm going to save you here, Matt, because you can't say yourself, but I know you want to say yourself.
Well, as David right. said, I've not seen you play, but I do think I'm better than David.
I'd like to have a rematch with you there, Matt. Now, I'd like to play you on that artificial grass surface that you refuse to play on. And with me at my Solihull Simon beating best.
Doesn't the belt holder sort of set the conditions of the next match? No.
And if I had had no back injury as well.
We travelled to Dorridge for the last one, David.
I've got no injuries at the moment. Let's get it on.
To be fair, I haven't played since then.
Right, well, tomorrow.
Whereas David's been thrashed by his kids on a regular basis. Right.
I got beaten by a 14-year-old last week.
The next question comes in from Ross McLeod, who's a regular listener of and contributed to the pod. He says, would either tour benefit from an FA Cup-style non-seeded draw?
Oh, yes.
Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes, Ross.
Yeah, but not for every tournament. I mean,
no, just as a novelty, one tournament a year thing.
100%. I'd love that. Mm. Where should that happen? I mean, for a start, I think that should definitely happen at the ATP and WTA finals. I don't think there should be seedings when you've got eight players.
Absolutely, yes, I'd agree with that. The issue is that tournaments would never support it because they want a system that guarantees, or not guarantees, but likely secures them their bigger names longer into the tournament, doesn't it? They don't want to increase the risk that Roger Federer loses early. So I think it's unlikely to happen for that reason. The players with the most power are the top-ranked players. They wouldn't want it. So as much as I think it's a no-brainer in terms of entertainment and what the spectator would enjoy, I can't, unfortunately, see it ever happening.
Ross has drawn a distinction there, or maybe drawn a distinction between the different tours. Would either tour benefit? Is it possible that the way the tours are quite different at the moment, where the men's, we've got a group of dominant players? I actually think the way tournaments are scheduled at the moment for years has benefited that style in terms of ensuring that most likely the best players are going to meet in the later rounds, the high-stake matches when most people are watching. So I think kind of it's been for the good of tennis, if you like, that draws have had seeds, and Djokovic, Nadal, Federer and Murray have met each other late in tournaments. But I don't know, when it's more open, like we've seen in the women's game more recently, perhaps that would favour this a bit more. But then I'm kind of thinking you've already got that a little bit. Seeds are kind of irrelevant in when it's so open. That I think that's what we like so much about women's Grand Slams, is that the first week, so many matches feel relevant to the outcome of the tournament, which hasn't happened in men's tennis for a while, I would say. You get matches where you just kind of know that, well, neither player's really got a chance of winning this tournament, but in the women's game, so many players have got a chance. I suppose this is an argument in favour of not having seeds, that you could get more matches like that early on at the start of an event.
Here's where I think I don't agree, Catherine, that a tournament should feel that they are letting go of their selling point. To me, it is a selling point on its own.
Oh, I don't agree either. I just think that resistance would be encountered, and it would probably be fatal.
You know, at a time when you've got people just trying to almost reinvent the game and going, in my opinion, way too far, like UTS and things like that, and why not just have what is really quite a subtle change, but a fantastic selling point of difference, to say we are the gloves off tour. We are, the handbrake is off this at this tournament. There's none of that. There's no protecting of seeds, of players, of rankings. You're in the draw. You come out. You play your match. Stop whinging. You know, what a brilliant selling point that would be.
But it would rely on sign up from big players, because the novelty doesn't really apply if you've got all players that wouldn't be high seeds at tournaments anyway. And I think they would be put off. They'd rather play, you know, if there were another tournament available that week. And
look, I think it needs to be a Masters tournament or something like that.
Would need to be a Masters. It would need to be either obligatory, a mandatory, or it would need to have massive money behind it to pay guarantees.
I just feel like there's so many tournaments that have come along, or platforms, and over the last year, including all the team events, and yet so many of them are just, they're basically the same tournaments. They're just called something different, or a different week, or in a different city. You could just really do something if you made that effort and just decided, we're going to market this. And right, Miami, okay, Indian Wells is, everybody's banging on about how wonderful Indian Wells is. Right, well, Miami's the anything goes tournament.
Somebody do it, come on. We've done the big sell, it's a no-brainer.
You mentioned the ATP finals and the WTA finals. I don't like round robin in tennis. I mean, I don't really like it in anything, but I know it's a selling point for the tournament in that they can guarantee players being in the draw for a certain amount of time and kind of selling sessions in advance. People know they're going to see the best players. But I've always thought that tennis works best when it's just straight knockout. And I personally would like to see the year-end finals have a different format. Just from a viewing perspective, I just think something needs to be done to slightly shake them up and make them slightly more interesting. And
There's very little I wouldn't do in order to eliminate dead rubbers from round robin events.
Top 16, knockouts, no seeds.
Yeah, it's just so counter to everything that's wonderful about sport. It feels like my sporting soul is dying when I'm watching a dead
rubber. It's like Champions League in football, when they have those group stages that I just take no notice of until they get into the knockout stages.
To a degree, I suppose, yeah. But anyway, we've gone beyond our brief there and just generally established how we think the tennis world should be. So take notice, everyone. Beth Fortin on Instagram says, since you travel a lot, not necessarily a very current comment, but yes, Beth, since you travel a lot, worst travel stories and best travel tips. Who would like to go first on this one?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I obviously haven't traveled as much as you two. My tip tends to be to try and avoid disasters, just because I'm timorous and worried about things going wrong all the time. I tend to be sort of highly organized and have slightly dull travel stories, I think, and trips. I've not really experienced any major disasters, but I know for a fact you have, so I will happily cede the floor.
And not for lack of preparation, diligence, and yes, Matt, the implication that disaster only befalls the unprepared is, I resent that. I am a get to the airport 3 hours early person.
Are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Look at the look of surprise on his face.
I am genuinely surprised by that.
Yes. Right, okay.
It's usually Catherine and me who have the tension.
I've only been late for a flight once, and it was I was with my dad, and we were flying home from the US Open, and they actually shut check-in like a minute early, so we weren't able to check in, but technically it was their fault. We got upgraded to first class, and it was just the best 8 hours of my life. They brought a dessert trolley round, and I said, can I have one of everything? I was like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Splendid.
I had my enormous tennis ball, which I'd got signed by a bunch of tennis players. I was wearing a hoodie, had this enormous tennis ball under my arm, and I sat there in first class, just having a little bit of every dessert.
Was this in 2004?
But that was my dad's fault that I was late for that flight. Sorry, Dad. Yes, 2004.
I had a missed connection at a missed flight once, having just got there in plenty of time, gone through the bag check-in, got through the other side. I don't know, sat there with my headphones on, didn't sit near a screen, and just sort of, oh, getting close here. I took my earphone out just to have a listen, and I heard something go up and saying, your flight is leaving. I thought, and I remember thinking, oh, that'd be a horrible position to be in, wouldn't it? And then I thought no more of it. And a few minutes later, I suddenly realised they'd been calling my name. And I just went hurtling towards the...
this is what I mean.
The plane. And it turned out it was me. And I missed the flight.
Did you make... Oh, you missed it.
Yeah, I had to buy another one. So that wasn't very good. Those are my early years. I learnt my lesson. But I've had a couple of others. I had one time I went to Australia, and I mean, this was three flights to get from where we are via Dubai and Singapore, and the flight to Dubai was at our end late because of bad weather in Birmingham where I was taking off from, and as a result of that I then missed the connection to Singapore, and the only way around, I mean, I can't exactly remember how I ended up going to Melbourne and had to go to Sydney as well. And by the time I'd done all that, the whole trip was well over 40 hours. That was pretty grim. It was supposed to be 2022 or something, and it ended up being over 40. So that wasn't great. And then there was the one when I was in my second year with the ATP, and I was at a tournament in Switzerland, the one that Roger Federer first played in Ingolstadt in Switzerland.
And, with the cow.
Yes, the cow one, where he got given a cow. And there was rain for 5 days, literally for 5 days, with no play at all. So they get to Friday and they're still in the first round. And the next week I've got a tournament in Croatia, which I'm supposed to be there on Saturday for, and yet I'm still there on Friday, and we haven't got past the first round yet. So I'm having to stay on. And I eventually got to the tournament in Croatia on the Wednesday, and the tournament started on the Monday. so I had to wait for this thing to finish. And then between the Wednesday and the final day, I met my wife. So that was quite good. That ended up all right.
You could have had an extra few days with her.
Yeah. So what can I say?
I think most of my horror travel story, not necessarily horror, character building travel stories centred around my time on the ATP Champions Tour when I worked for David. Sometimes I look back on some of those memories and think, did I really do that? They all make me sound extremely adventurous, but of course at the time you're just sort of going along with things. I got quarantined in a hotel room in Chengdu.
I was waiting for Chengdu to come up in the worst travel stories segment.
Yeah, Chengdu was not an epic time in my life. I did subsequently return to Chengdu and eventually got to see the pandas. So I have had a positive Chengdu experience since then, but my first trip there was pretty scarring. It was sort of just doomed from the word go. The flight was cancelled, and then I missed my connecting flight, and then I got there and was ill and ended up quarantined in this hotel room. And then the return flight was delayed due to horrendous smog. Sat on the tarmac at Chengdu Airport for about 8 hours with no air conditioning. Then we were told to disembark the plane, and Chengdu Airport only had holes in the ground for toilets. And if this is the same trip where I ended up in a one-star Beijing airport hotel with Yevgeny Kafelnikov, Thomas Enquist, and Sergey Bruguera. So there
we go. Is it the mosquitoes one?
No, that was in Milan. That was an ATP Champions Tour trip to Milan, probably around about 2014, where there were a couple of mosquitoes trapped in my room. Well, actually, there were a lot more than that. I killed most of them during a period of several hours in the middle of the night, just in a frenzy, in my pajamas on the mattress, just trying to catch mosquitoes. And anyway, I couldn't catch them all. Ended up with, I think, more than 30 mosquito bites about my person. Complained to reception numerous times, and they sent a maintenance guy who sort of walked in the room and went, "Oh, yeah, mosquitoes," and walked out. Anyway, in the end, they said they couldn't possibly move my room because they were completely full. So I thought I had actually lost my mind, because I went and locked myself in the bathroom and I could hear mosquitoes buzzing in my ears in there. Mosquitoes were following me wherever I went. So I picked up my pillow and I took myself downstairs and I lay down on the sort of chaise longue in the lobby and said, "Well, if you can't find me a room without flesh-eating insects, then I shall sleep here." And lo and behold, a room materialised quite quickly, because nobody wants a sort of semi-dressed Catherine Whittaker asleep in their lobby, it turns out.
Not when she's not happy. Can you believe?
I also got detained by the ash cloud, got stranded in Barcelona, and had to drive from Barcelona to over the French border, ended up in Montpellier, stayed overnight at a winery in Montpellier. Thank you, ATP Champions Tour. That was great. Then hired another car in Montpellier and drove it up to Paris, where in Paris just about managed to get a Eurostar, despite just horrendous queues because everybody was trying to get home because there were no flights anywhere. Oh, and a trip to Santiago in Chile, great city, but I think it was the last of a sequence of quite a lot of long-haul trips, and none of my ploys to get upgraded. There was no low that I wouldn't stoop to try and get upgraded from economy. There's nothing as depressing than sort of bumping into Pat Cash in the at the boarding and then watching him turn left while you turn right.
You needed your dad.
Yeah, so I'd had my fill of that, so I thought, right, this time, did a bit of Googling about ways to get upgrades. Anyway, I wore a splint and a sling on my right arm.
Catherine!
And didn't work. I wore it at check-in thinking, this is bound to work. Did my saddest face. Didn't work there. I thought, I'll keep it on because they can still upgrade you at the gate. I'll do my most pathetic face at the gate. Didn't think that all the way through because I then didn't get upgraded at the gate, but then you can't remove it straight away. So then I had to board the aircraft wearing the sling and the splint. But then all of the crew have seen me in the sling and the splint. Anyway, 13-hour flight to Santiago, had to keep the splint and the sling on all the way in order to save face. And it was really itchy and uncomfortable. So I had my comeuppance.
That is the universe getting you back a bit, I think. God. Mm-hmm.
Matt, can you believe
Matt.
She still talks to me. And I sent her on all these trips. She was working for me. I mean, if you ever wonder why there's a bit of tension.
It was great. As I said, character building. Mm. So that's three questions, and we're 30 minutes in.
We've got another show next week. It's all right.
Good job we're doing 4,000 podcasts between now and the end of the year.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free
or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hannah Thompson asks, who, if anyone, would you bring into Tsitsipas's team to take him up a level? Who should coach Tsitsipas?
Oh, anyone. My word. That's a good question. I think only a consultant type, because I just don't think you can remove his dad. If somebody wants to come in and take over and ditch the dad, I don't see that working. I think he can't. He needs his dad around. He loves his dad. He wants to be rid of his dad. He doesn't want him not there.
Can his dad not be around but not coaching him? There are examples of that. I mean, look,
I don't 100% know, but that's why I kind of think if there could be a consultant that his dad was okay with, somebody who could, because the other thing is, I really don't think there's much wrong with Tsitsipas's game as it is. There's a couple of tweaks, it seems to me. Technically, he needs to smooth out a couple of things. I don't know how big those jobs are. The serve one that requires the footwork, as Mary calls it, and the backhand return, particularly against the big servers, and the use of a slice, and just how best to go about handling his own backhand. And I don't know how big those jobs are, really. I don't know whether it's sort of, right, employ somebody for 2 months in an off-season and just sort it, or whether it's somebody you've got to have around all the time. I don't think mentally he's got, on the court, a big problem or anything like that. I mean, yes, there was that worry over losing those big leads and shanking and all that sort of thing, but his French Open was good. So I kind of think he'll probably work through those things. I think if you took his dad away, he would just be depressed. He wouldn't want to be. He wouldn't want to do it.
Mm. I always find questions about who should be someone's coach really hard. They're so interesting, but there's so much that goes into a coaching dynamic. And I think you see so many coaching relationships not last very long because so much of it is about personal chemistry and connection rather than necessarily what they're actually telling you about tennis. I think people do often say that a tennis coach is a bit like, you know, the role is a bit like being a parent in a way, and that what your aim is so that they can do it without you, I suppose, because you're not able to help them on the court. And I do wonder with Tsitsipas's dad. I completely agree with you, David. I think he tried that 1 week, didn't he, without him in Rome, I think, and yeah, he was close to a breakdown, I think, by the end of that, not having his dad around. But perhaps the recognition that something needs to change or something could change needs to come from the dad. He might be the one who needs to say, I still think my voice is important, but I think you need another voice. I think there's something that I can't give you that someone else would be able to give you. And maybe it's not about completely removing that voice altogether, but bringing in someone else, or I don't know. I think there is a way that someone could come in and the dad could still remain a crucial part of it. But I'm not sure who's going to be the catalyst of that change, whether it's Stefanos or the dad. I don't know. I think my hunch is that it might, in the end, have to come from the dad. I think actually Zverev's dad has done that in terms of letting Alexander have other coaches. He used to be way more involved than he is now. He's still there, but he's not as big a presence as he was. And I don't know whether Tsitsipas might have a similar evolution.
I do. When you were saying there about the technical stuff, David, and I'm in the same boat as you in terms of not knowing how big those tweaks are and how long they might take to correct. But in terms of the technical side of things, Magnus Norman sprung to mind, having done so much good with Stan Wawrinka in that respect. That chip backhand return, I think, is the one area that Tsitsipas is lacking for me.
Plus, but he's in so terms ego of, free, isn't he, Magnus Norman? That
absolutely, and I can see him fitting into a system where there is somebody else significant on the seam, such as Apostolos. But there's also a part of me that thinks that, sort of, kind of aside from the tennis, he needs somebody that, after he loses or doesn't quite play his best, just puts it into perspective a bit for him. And I don't mean that to sound almost one of the things I like so much about Tsitsipas is his lack of perspective sometimes, the fact that it is completely life and death to him. But equally, I do think it would be beneficial if he could have somebody travelling with him that would just take him out for a beer after he's lost, or, you know, just help him with the lighter side of things in maybe a fatherly type mentoring role. I mean, Marcus Baghdatis is obviously the one that springs to mind because we know that they have a really close pre-existing relationship. Baghdatis has had a bit of a foray into coaching with Svitolina, albeit not a successful one. But I still think for the right player, he has the potential to be a really good coach. And he's such a laid-back guy and easy to get along with. Again, I think he could mesh with an existing setup. But it is going to be interesting how the Tsitsiposse, as Mary Carrillo calls it, how that evolves over time. It's going to be really interesting. We have a question from Ryan Lenihan on Twitter, who asks, if you could change one Wimbledon tradition, what would it be and why? Matt?
Well, there are two that I would want to change, I think. One is the wording of all white. I think that's been a regression. I think it was better when it was predominantly white. And I think even allowing colour, I think, would be better than what we currently have with all white for various reasons. And secondly, I would slightly restructure the tournament. I think Wimbledon's the only Grand Slam which doesn't make good enough use of the weekends. I think that's when more people can watch, and I think it's a shame that they only use three weekend days in their tournament because they have the Sunday off. I understand why they have to have the Sunday off. I used to hate Middle Sunday as a fan. I now, incidentally, love it. but obviously they need, preferably, to have a day off so that the grass can heal and be more playable in the second week. I understand there are sort of reasons for that. So I guess I would slightly restructure to maybe start on a Sunday, a bit like the French Open. I don't know what, I'm sure Wimbledon wouldn't want to do that probably, but I think start on a Sunday, play a full week, including the middle weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and have the day off on the Monday. Now that would eradicate Manic Monday as a thing. That would no longer be a day that would happen where all the round fours were on the same day, because you'd have time to fit them in over 2 days like the other slams. But again, my view on that has probably slightly changed as well. I used to absolutely love that day. Now I think I miss too much on that. There's too much great tennis on. So those are the two I would do. Include more weekends and change the all-white clothing policy.
If the reason for Middle Sunday is solely the healing, loved that word, Matt, of the grass, the spiritual, sensual, sexual healing of the grass at Wimbledon, there are ways to do that and not miss a whole day. You could have a rotation system of fallow courts over the course of, say, the Friday to Monday, couldn't you? You could have, I don't know how many courts are there total, you could have four or five fallow courts on each of those days rotating so that each court had one day of healing roughly midway through the tournament. And then in terms of the spectator, TV-wise, and mostly visitor-wise, you wouldn't miss that much, and you would have a full 2 weeks of tennis and full 2 weekends of tennis. A crop rotation system, like in medieval agriculture, what could be more traditional?
How do you feel about a day off, though, in the middle of a slam?
Oh, selfishly, love it, but from the outside, ludicrous.
Do you think?
I think if they could get away with it with the courts, I would get rid of it now.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I would. I feel like I agree. The Monday is a mess, really. Although it's exciting, it's too much. It's too much all at once, and you can't savor enough of the moments. And I want to see that spread out a little bit more, personally. And yet, obviously, I love it from a working perspective, but that's irrelevant, really. The all-white rule, I'm sort of nostalgic for some of the incredible designs of the 80s that I used to love on the Adidas shirts, in particular at Wimbledon, things that Edberg and Lendl used to wear, things that I wanted to own, which I'm quite sure I'd not be that fussed about owning just an all-white branded, just with a logo on it, shirt of Nadal, Federer, Murray, whoever it is, because pretty much there's hardly anything you can do with it. At the same time, from a tournament perspective as a brand, that's so strong, just being all-white. I think there's the bigger problem is the lack of consideration for periods. In that rule is definitely an issue. But I think maybe that nostalgia I have for those predominantly all-white designs of the 80s overlooks the number of horrors that were also accompanying those lovely, wonderful one-offs that I remember, because there were so many appalling designs that it wasn't all great. The only other thing I wanted to do is ask you. I mean, you know that I still like queuing, for instance. Now, that things may change because of COVID-19 for the future. Now, I'm quite sure it'll have to change for, say, next year. But just quickly, I mean, Catherine, you and I have talked about this at some length in previous shows, but would you, yes or no, ditch the queue?
Yes. I don't think it's fair.
I would ditch it as well, yeah.
I think it's an absolute... tremendous work of PR, and I don't mean that as a slight. I really do think it's a tremendous work of PR that the queue is this celebrated thing. But I think actually, once you dig down into it, it's a little bit sinister. I don't think you should have to sleep rough to obtain tickets to one of the best and most important sporting events in the country. I would also add to that. A kids' day is essential and a no-brainer at Wimbledon. It's the only Grand Slam that doesn't have one. I know why it doesn't have one. It's not in keeping with the brand. Use of the grass in advance of the tournament starting. You know, they don't hold the qualifying at Wimbledon. But I think those are all things that can be worked around. I think find solutions to those problems and have a kids' day. Because
they're getting closer to that, I think, aren't they? In as much as they are doing kids' activities on site, they're just not doing a big, fat kids' day.
But we have seen, and I hate the experience of being there, but I've seen the power of those kids' days, the look in those kids' eyes, them thinking tennis is just the coolest. And I think that's a no-brainer.
You mentioned there about the courts not being able to be used before the tournament starts, that kind of thing. Well, I do think when they do have the land across the road, I think they can really get creative with it. And I think they probably will. All the elements of redesign of the Wimbledon grounds have been amazing over the last few years. And I think once they've got that, they've got so much more space.
That's the thing. Wimbledon has the luxury of options and money to implement those options, and to do it well and in keeping with their traditions, because they have always nailed that, embracing change. Whenever they've taken that step to make changes in keeping with their tradition, they've always nailed it.
Yeah.
So I would trust them to do all this right if they would just take the step of actually doing it.
And I also believe, I'm pretty sure I read something that they were considering relaxing the all-white clothing policy this year. Obviously, Wimbledon didn't happen, but I'm not sure how far they will go with that. But I think it's something to look out for next year, that there might be a subtle change.
Yeah, for me, if it were one thing, it would be the all-white clothing policy. I feel very strongly about it. I accept that it's an incredibly strong element of Wimbledon's brand. I don't deny that. I'm sure they consider that to be of great value. I don't really care. I think it's extraordinary that women are made to do physical activity in all white whilst menstruating. I think that's unreal when you really break it down. And I think that rule in the first place would have been put into place by someone that's never menstruated, and it's perpetuated by virtue of tradition. And it's again, it's a fantastic work of PR, but I think it's unacceptable.
Well said.
Okay, so that's about seven things each of us would change about Wimbledon. The question only asked for one, but you're welcome, Ryan, for your bonus balls there. What else do we have here? Matt Carter on Twitter asks, has the trend for tribalistic fan support of players always been a thing, or is it a relatively new phenomenon brought about by social media, and how detrimental is it to the game? David, you've recently... well, not recently, you have consistently and repeatedly got on the wrong side of vehement Twitter fan support of various tennis players. What's your take on this question?
My favourite one was when in the same day I had notes from Djokovic, Federer and Nadal fans telling me how appallingly I treat their specific player. I really enjoyed that one.
There was a message on our Instagram this week saying... I see Catherine has picked Tsitsipas to win Vienna in the newsletter. It's usually David that picks Tsitsipas for things. I'm surprised that that Catherine, who usually never picks Tsitsipas, has picked Tsitsipas. And shame on Matt for never, ever picking Tsitsipas.
I mean, look, I'm quite people used to support players, and there used to be fantastic divides of... I remember being, you were either a Borg or a McEnroe fan. I remember those years. I remember in Australia, in the early years that I discovered the Australian Open, the incredible support of the Swedes and the chanting that went on between rival support groups. But you just weren't, I just don't feel that unless you were in a tennis stadium, you weren't really aware of people's fandom. That's the difference. Yes, the mud. I'm sure journalists got sent letters when they wrote about a player or something like that. But it's just this freedom of an opinion, isn't it? This freedom of being able to say whatever you like, whenever you like, on social media, whenever it occurs to you, fire it off. Make sure, unless they're blocked, make sure the person you're directing it towards reads it and has it right in front of their face immediately. It just ends up self-perpetuating as a result of that. So I do feel like the tribal element in tennis certainly is largely a result of social media. I do feel that. I mean, I think it's brought about initially by very strong ties to a player of note, and these players have been around for a long time, so people have got enough time to build those real affiliations and stick with them and then go at each other as a result. But the way that it kind of gets out of hand, I think, is a social media element. And I mean, I do feel like I've wanted to remove myself from it compared to what I used to feel like. it bothers me now much, much more than it used to.
Mm. I mean, I think passionate support is a good thing. I wouldn't say it is detrimental to the game. I think it can easily tip from passionate support into abuse, I think, on social media. The main issue I have with social media and tennis is the way that we've seen quite a lot of players be open about the messages they receive just from losing a match that someone had bet on them to win. I mean, that I believe the sport is doing something to combat that and to expose the people who do send those messages. But I think in terms of fan support on social media, I think one of the shames for me is that any kind of discussion about Federer, Nadal or Djokovic ends up a kind of pile on from the other set of fan bases. And that's a shame. I also think it's weird how that's happened when you consider the actual people that they're supporting who have never conducted themselves like that. But I think it says more about social media than it does tennis. But it's interesting that you think it's bigger now, this idea of fan support because of social media. And I suppose that does make sense.
It may just be a perception thing, though, because I can see it. I can't... You can turn a blind eye, but if you want to be involved in a conversation and comment about a tennis match or a tennis player, you've got to accept that you're out there to be piled on. If you say something that is against a fan base's player,
it can't just be perception, though, can it? Because there are things that people say on social media that they simply wouldn't say in real life, wouldn't have opportunity to, because there'd be no one there to listen to them. Wouldn't have a platform or audience for it. I mean, I do think I am instinctively uncomfortable with the word fan now, which I can't remember when that happened, whether it's always been the case. I don't remember it changing or feeling like it had changed. But to me, the word fan inherently means irrational and unreasonable support. As you say, there's a distinction now for me between passionate support of someone. And I watch sport and passionately support people and teams. But there's a difference between that and fandom, which for me implies something of the irrational and the inability to be reasonable. And kind of anybody that describes themselves as a fan, and this is probably unfair because there are plenty of people that would describe themselves as a fan and mean it by what I consider to be my old definition, David, as you describe sort of Borg and McEnroe fans. I kind of disregard their views on things if they describe themselves as a fan, because I think, well, you're not applying reason, logic or rationality to what you're saying. And I know that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because there will be plenty of self-described fans
almost
that are able
word.
To apply those things, but I am edgy about that word.
I feel that
like social media is a massive contributor to my change in perception of that word. Yeah, well, support. I mean, for example, you're a fan of a football team, aren't you? And I think we'd all admit and understand that we're all completely irrational about the football teams that we support. That is fandom, and that is. It is tribal. Football is tribal. It's inherently very tribal. Tennis hasn't always been that way, but it does feel like it's become it.
I agree with you there. I feel sorry for people who are proper fans, are fans who are decent in their way they carry themselves, because this isn't the same thing at all. When I was a kid, there was something called football hooliganism, and they tried to hide under the name fan. And I used to go to grounds and feel awful as a kid when hooliganism was going on around me, and I remember seeing it. Now, sometimes this becomes a virtual version of that, and It really does bother me. It isn't fair on the many listeners who are listening to this thing. Well, I'm a fan, and I wouldn't behave like that, you know. And so you almost need a new word. I feel like the way we ended up having hooligan to describe the people that carried out what was just violence, not supporting a team, but bringing shame on that team. And that's what a lot of these people do. I feel is they bring shame on the player that they are connecting themselves with in order to dish out abuse.
And they can find a sense of community and belonging in it, because you'll say something of that type on Twitter and then immediately 25 other people will pop up to defend you, and you'll feel a sense of belonging and validation. I think that's what you can get from Twitter. You can find validation in your views, no matter how unsavory or irrational, whereas before you could just have your views and they'd be knocking around in your head, but you wouldn't have anyone to validate them and feel like they were worth shouting from the rooftops. So I do think things have changed. Sadly. Oh, what a wonderful world. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. Do you think we can cover off what are the worst five set matches you've had to sit through from Chris Ayres in that time?
I'm going with Kevin Anderson against John Isner at Wimbledon.
That was my one.
What was it, 2 years ago? Because of so many reasons. Yeah. I mean, I think it was 6 hours and 36 minutes. It was 26-24 in the fifth. It was the match that brought about the fifth set tiebreak at Wimbledon for the first time and was basically announced by Tim Henman on live television, even though he couldn't officially do it. He knew it was going to have to happen or that it was coming, and therefore he thought he'd get it in there so that everybody would calm down. It's the match that pushed back Nadal against Djokovic so that they couldn't get the thing done in the night on the day it was supposed to be played. It was called off at about 11 p.m. at 2-1, ended up carrying over to the next day, causing the women's final to be a not before. And I don't mean this as disrespect to Kevin Anderson and John Isner, who played an excellent match the way they play matches, but because of the styles that they have, put them against each other, and it's a snore fest for the most part. We had Justin Gilmour-Stubb standing up for the whole match in the front row of the players' box with his fist raised in the direction of John Isner, and most people I know were just hoping it would end. Now, that's not me just saying, five-set tennis has no place anymore, but the worst thing you can ever have is a five-set match where the players are not playing well at the same time. That's when I tune out, to be honest.
Oh, what a joy it was to relive that match, David.
Feel free to add to that.
Matt, have you got anything worse than that?
Well, the caveat for me on that one is that I didn't watch it. I was working at Wimbledon that year, and I was on a shift. I didn't have to watch that. By the end, I was kind of enjoying it. Just because it reached that stage where how absurd can it get? And part of me does enjoy that. But as I said, I didn't have to watch it, and I think it was a bore. The worst one, this might be recency bias, but the worst one for me is Zverev Carreño Busta the other week at the US Open.
Perfect example of not playing well at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, both playing badly at the same time.
I would also add in on the recency bias front, Diego Schwartzman and Cameron Norrie at the US Open.
I was going to say Cameron Norrie in the first round the year before.
Mary got commentating
on while Serena Sharapova was going on the Ash Stadium.
Poor Cameron Norrie.
Speaking of Twitter, I do remember Twitter being excellent during that Zverev Carreño Busta match I mentioned. I tweeted from the podcast account, what techniques have you all found to make it through Carreño Busta versus Zverev? And we had about 90 replies, and some of them were just, you know, making memes, doing other things, answering emails, cleaning the kitchen, mowing the lawn, filling out the census, making salads, drinking, playing online Scrabble, gone to bed, turned it off, you know, so...
Oh, that's so great.
People were
coping
in
mechanisms.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great note to end on. We got loads more questions, so we'll be doing more of these. And we'll be back on Monday, won't we, to talk about tennis. We'll be wrapping up Vienna, looking ahead to Paris, the ATP Masters 1000 event happening there as we stand at the moment. We are expecting it still to happen, despite the fact that France and Paris is going into pretty much a full national lockdown this week. The understanding at the moment, and the latest we've heard is from Chris Clary on Twitter, is that they think that sporting events will still go ahead. They're waiting for the final specific green light from the government. But the understanding at the moment is that the Paris Masters... will go ahead in behind closed doors, obviously, and in very strange and uncertain circumstances. But such is the world we're living in. I mean, the situation in London, in the UK, is extremely uncertain at the moment. We understand that the ATP finals will go ahead regardless of the lockdown status in the UK. But anyway, enough of that misery. Let's just keep making podcasts to keep our minds off it all, shall we?
Good idea. Let's do that.
Matt, we have shout-outs. Who would we like to shout out to today?
We have Chris Camara.
Hey, Chris.
Like Chris Camara?
No.
Right.
K-U-M-M-E-R-E-R.
This one's better.
A little bit like Chris Camara, though.
Yeah, sort of.
Imagine being a bit like Chris Camara.
It's a Chris Camara, Roger Federer merge.
Oh, come on.
I definitely prefer our Chris Camara.
Scott Levy or Levy. I know there's some debate over how that's pronounced.
If you're going with the Levies of Schitt's Creek fame, then it's obviously Levy. But if you're going with our dear friend David Silver, quite Levy, then Levy.
Do
quite
let us know, Scott, and thanks for your support.
Mm.
And finally to Vin Allen Nguyen.
Like Vin Diesel?
V-I-N-H.
A little bit like Vin Diesel.
Well, thank you for your support, whatever.
God, we've got cool listeners. Right then.
We have got cool listeners, haven't we?
Thank you for all your support and hello. We'll be back with another Tennis podcast on Monday. There'll be two of them next week. Plenty more questions. If we didn't get to yours, I'm sure we will eventually, unless it was rubbish and it wasn't selected for answering. But there weren't many of those. So thanks very much for sending all your questions in. Hello to all of our mascots. Hello, Cam. Hanging in there. We're thinking of you. And we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.